Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Interesting day. I guess the biggest story in the news today right now, and we'll get back to this in a little bit, is Ron Suskind, or Suskind, depending on how you on where you are and how you say it, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who has a new book out that says basically George Tenet and all these guys knew that there was no link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and yet they were given the task of promoting that. And so here's, and by the way, Monday, next Monday, Ron Suskind will be on our program talking about this. But this is this morning he was on the Today Show, Ron Suskind.
Well, the CIA folks involved in the book and others talk about George coming back, Tenet coming back from the White House with the assignment.
The assignment being sell the American people, you know, find some link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, even though there was no link.
On White House stationery and turning to the CIA operatives who are professionals saying, you may not like this, but here's our next mission. And they carried it through step by step all the way to the finish. And ultimately, people even talked about it after the fact. It was a dark day for the CIA. It was the kind of thing where they said, look, this is not our charge. We're not here to carry forward a political mandate, which is clearly what this was, to solve a political problem in America. And it was a cause of great grievance inside of the agency.
But you heard what Tenet said. We asked for a statement from him, and this is what he said. There was no such order from the White House to me, nor, to the best of my knowledge, was anyone from CIA ever involved in any such effort. It is well established that at my direction, CIA resisted efforts on the part of some in the administration to paint a picture of Iraq Al-Qaeda connections that went beyond the evidence. The notion that I would suddenly reverse our stance and have created and planted to this false evidence that was contrary to our own beliefs is ridiculous.
Now, the problem with this, of course, is that George Tenet, everybody around him says it happened. The documents say it happened. The only guy who says it didn't happen is George Tenet himself.
He calls it ridiculous.
Well, you know, this is, I think, part of George's memory issue. He's dealt with this before in front of congressional investigators and
others. You don't think he remembered this letter?
Well, he seems not to remember it. And, you know, that's at least what he claims. And the fact is, a lot of people know about this. I know about it from my last book. And so in this book, Meredith, instead of going to George, I went to all the people around George, close to George, who remember because they were involved in the thing, and they remember what George says to them.
So anyhow, we'll get into that as we continue through the day, and of course we'll be back on that on Monday with Ron Suskind. But I just wanted to this I think is probably one of the biggest stories, because what this proves, and Ron Suskind, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, proves, is that George W. Bush lied to us, and as a consequence of those lies with regard to the Iraq. As a consequence of those lies, you've got at least a couple hundred thousand dead people and 4.5 million refugees, and the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad and other cities is an absolute disaster. Climate change. Climate change is we talked a couple days ago here with Mark Morano, and Dan Gaynor is with us right now. He's with the Business and Media Institute. In fact, he's the vice president of the Business and Media Institute. Business and Media, andmedia.org, is their website. And James Clyburn, the African-American number two guy in the House of Representatives, recently has come out and said, that climate change is hitting the minority community harder than anybody else. And, Dan, you would beg to differ, I guess.
Well, I think bigger than anything, begging to differ. I think it's just it's a classic Washington politician trying to leverage whatever he can to get more money for what he considers to be his constituency. I mean, I would beg to differ about whether climate change is the big mega threat that is painted, and he paints it. But, I mean, I think...
Well, you've got, I mean, right here in Oregon, we've got the glacier on Mount Hood over the last 30 years has lost 35% of its mass. It's causing, you know, bigger floods in our rivers, bigger droughts during the summer, bigger floods in the spring. This is happening all over the world. Africa, which accounts, this is in the New York Times, which accounts for less than 3% of global emissions of carbon dioxide, 840 million people are facing the risk of drought and disrupted water supplies directly as a consequence of climate change.
No, see, just because it's the New York Times doesn't make it true. I mean,
well, the New York Times quoting the world's leading scientists. Yeah, Dan, you're not going to try this global warming denier stuff.
Climate changes. Yeah, I land wonderfully in the middle, like journalists are supposed to land. There are scientists on both sides.
There are not scientists on both sides, Dan. You've got scientists who have no agenda, or scientists who are looking at real science on the science, saying, "Look, there is something really going on here." And then you've got a bunch of sellouts and shills and liars for the oil industry on the other side.
The Earth has cooled in the last 10 years. The Hadley Center. That's not me.
The Earth is not cooling in the last 10 years. Dan, stop right there, Dan. Stop for a minute. Hang on. 1998. You had one anomalous year where the temperature spiked higher than it has ever spiked. Now, if you take 1998 out of the equation and you look at from 1997 till now, every single year has got warmer. You go all the way back to the 1950s, every single year has gotten warmer. You guys take that one spiked year of 1998, you say, hey, it's gotten cooler every year since 1998. No, it hasn't. That's a lie.
Not counting this past winter. No, it has not gotten warmer. This past winter wasn't cool. It was record cool. Remember the blizzards they had in China? I mean, that blizzards they'd never seen before. They had millions of people stranded around.
That's why it's called climate change, Dan.
But yes. But
at the same time, the Arctic is melting.
The glacier problem you're discussing, you can go back to 1900 and find LA Times stories talking about the declining glaciers. And then you can go to 2000 or so and find the same newspaper talking about the same glaciers declining. So what happened in the intervening time? They declined, then they grew again. It's what they do. All right, so what we really need, I mean, before people start screaming at each other about climate change, is to get the scientists, and there are hundreds of scientists on the other side. There are a lot of people who question the IPCC.
Not real
political
scientists,
process.
Dan.
Yeah, there are scientists.
No, I've been through the list, you know, that Mark Morano gave us. Half those people have a BA in something.
Let's talk about Bill Gray. He's the most foremost, big weather expert in the country, the guy who the media and a lot of scientists love to go to talk about hurricanes, tropical storms, etc.
Are you talking about a guy who's a meteorologist?
Yeah.
Meteorologists are not climate scientists. Meteorologists are weathermen.
And that's what basically climatologists are, writ large. They are trying to predict the weather instead of a few days in advance or a few months in advance, trying to predict it 100 years. Which doesn't take into account any technological, weather, or otherwise change.
Dan, this is like trying to compare somebody who had a Red Cross course in CPR with a brain surgeon for a discussion of brain tumors.
Of course, that's ludicrous.
I see your weatherman, and I raise you 2,600 actual scientists who were signed on to the IPCC by the UN, United Nations.
PhD in geophysical sciences in 64, MS in meteorology, University of College, University of Chicago in 59. Even his wiki, which, of course, is not exactly the most conservative institution in the world, considered as a pioneer in science of forecasting hurricanes.
He can write his own wiki. You can write your own wiki.
You can have people change it. Trust me, it happens. Here is a guy who has been an expert in predicting hurricanes, which a lot of people were talking about in relation to climate change. Every time we have a big storm, somebody somewhere tries to link it to climate change. So you would think, that this is a guy you would listen to. He is a guy everybody listens to, except when he talks climate change. Then they say, oh, he's crazy, because he's actually talking about global cooling. And he says that's a bigger threat than global warming. One, because more people die when it gets cold than they do when it gets warm. And it's weather facts. People die when it gets cold. It's a miserable climate. There's a reason why we call the Middle Ages the medieval optimum, because it was considered to be optimum for mankind to expand.
Dan, are you trying to suggest to me that our having crossed the 350 parts per million threshold of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which James Hansen from NASA is saying is now a turning point for the possible future viability of the human race, the ability of your and my children or grandchildren to survive, is irrelevant?
I'm saying he says possibility. I sat and testified in front of the U.S. Senate on climate change and media coverage, etc. There were four
scientists. Hansen is no longer saying possibility.
There were four scientists on that panel, two who agreed that climate change is a big danger, two who didn't, one who pointed out that if you look at what has happened historically, what happens with carbon dioxide, or, you know, in the atmosphere, is it deleted? It leads, you're followed up by cooling, not warming.
Man, I'm so sorry to hear this, Dan. People can read all about it over at businessandmedia.org. Dan Gaynor, the Vice President of the Business and Media Institute. Thanks, Dan, for stopping
by.
Always
a pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, The Real People's Radio. Our program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. You can find out more at teamster.org. You know, the thing that makes me crazy about this, and I think it's so important that we keep bringing these topics forward, because they're going to play hugely in the election and you know, this ongoing, particularly when it gets down and after the election. Actually, I think it's going to even be a bigger deal, because that's, yeah, assuming that we have a strong Democratic House and Senate, and, you know, the at this point 50-50 chance that we'll have a Democratic president, that the whole issue of cap and trade and carbon and what carbon does and how it, you know, how, you know, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and methane, other carbon containing gases in the atmosphere, and not just the atmosphere, the oceans and all these kinds of things. This is all going to be a big deal, because there's this huge carbon industry out there. And so, for example, Mr. Gray, Louise, that was cited by Dan in our last guest, in our last segment, you know, we just took a look at, what's the website?
ExxonSecrets.org.
And sure enough, there he is, working for the Heartland Institute, which is funded by ExxonMobil. And the fact of the matter is, 1998, get this in your head. If you were to see a vertical bar graph of temperature, year-by-year temperature, you see this steady slope upwards starting in the 1940s, 1950s, and it's just steadily, steadily rising all the way up till today, with one exception, 1998, it leaped up so high that it was even higher than this year, last year, or any of the years since 1998. 1998 was an anomalous year. Nobody's sure exactly why. Maybe there was a volcano someplace. Maybe that. There's been actually a number of possible suggestions, but nonetheless, 1998 was incredibly hot, 10 years ago, incredibly hot. And yet it has been, you know, 1999 was warmer than 1997, and 2000 was warmer than 1999, and 2001 was warmer than 2000, and it's continuously been going up. but it still hasn't gotten as hot as it was in that one year, 1998, that one anomalous year. So these guys come on and say, and I was just astounded to hear Dan Gaynor say this, because I you know, Dan's been on the show many times, and as you know, regular listeners of the program, I absolutely do not trash people when they're not around to defend themselves. And I had always believed that Dan believed what he was saying, and there was some integrity to what he was saying, at least in his own mind. And when he pulled 1998 out, I just, my jaw dropped. I mean, you may have noticed toward the end, I'm so sorry to hear this. I am just so sorry to hear this, because anybody who says it's been getting cooler since 1998, unless they are just an absolute dupe, knows that the information that they're presenting is just a plain old flat-out lie. And I just find that so, frankly, tragic. And what's even more tragic is I guarantee you the news media, just like Congress, we got two guys on the side of climate change. We got to have two guys against the side of climate change. You know, what? Let's have a fair and balanced discussion about whether the world is flat. Anyhow, the original topic that we were going to discuss is whether this disproportionately hurts minorities. And James Clyburn, he said African Americans are more vulnerable to higher energy bills, unemployment, recessions caused by global energy price shocks, and a greater economic burden from military operations designed to protect the flow of oil to the U.S. Yes! And as the world warms here, the IPCC, this is the UN's organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says wealthy nations far from the equator are not only experiencing fewer effects, but also better able to withstand them. But poorer nations closer to the equator, like Africa, accounts for 3% of global emissions, yet its 840 million people face some of the biggest risks from drought and disrupted water supplies. And you know, I've been there. I've seen it. I was in southern Sudan and on the border with Darfur, where the desert is moving south. It's moving south so fast you can see where it wasn't desert just a year ago, and it is now. You know, the remnants of trees sticking through, soil that is now desert. I mean, it's just that's what it is. You've got the Ganges River, the glaciers that feed the Ganges, which is providing water and food to millions, tens of millions of people, perhaps hundreds of millions of people in India. Those glaciers are starting to melt. All through the Himalayas, glaciers melting. And China is looking at serious problems as their rivers are starting to dry up, not just because of agriculture use, but because, again, the glaciers that feed them, the mountainous glaciers, are starting to melt. Down in South America, the same thing. In the Andes, in Peru, in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Colombia, all around there, the water supplies are starting to diminish. The river flows are starting to diminish. It is really starting to freak out a lot of people in the third world, a lot of people in poor and undeveloped countries. And on top of that, all this carbon dioxide in the air is now starting to change the pH of the ocean. And just yesterday, there was a piece in the paper about how jellyfish are showing up everywhere. 300 people hospitalized for jellyfish stings in Spain. Why? Because jellyfish are the cockroaches of the ocean. As all the fish are dying off, as everything else is dying off, the jellyfish are left. 27 minutes.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman here with you. And, hey, we have the inside skinny here on the G.W. Bush Presidential Library, now in its planning stages. And, maybe. Let's see, the George W. Bush Presidential Library, some of the rooms, the Hurricane Katrina room, which is still under construction, the Alberto Gonzalez Room, where you won't be able to remember anything. By the way, thanks, tip of the hat to Souz, S-O-O-Z-C, in the chat room for our for this alert. The Alberto Gonzalez Room, where you won't be able to remember anything. The Texas Air National Guard Room, where you don't even have to show up. The Walter Reed Hospital Room, where they don't let you in. The Guantanamo Bay Room, where they don't let you out. The Weapons of Mass Destruction Room, where no one has ever been able to find. The National Debt Room, which is huge and has no ceiling. The Tax Cut Room, with entry only to the wealthy. The Economy Room, which is in the toilet. The Iraq War Room, after you complete your first tour, they make you go back for a second, third, fourth, and sometimes fifth tour. The Dick Cheney Room, in the famous undisclosed location, complete with shotgun gallery. The Environmental Conservation Room, still empty. The Supreme Court Gift Shop, where you can buy an election. The Airport Men's Room, where you can meet some of your favorite Republican senators. The Decider Room, complete with dartboard, magic eight ball, Ouija board, dice, coins, and straws. And finally, the museum with an electron microscope to help you locate the president's accomplishments. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, by the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, you can find our live video stream free on the web, as is our audio stream as well. Tim in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Well, doing pretty well, Tom. Actually, the damage has already been done due to global warming. I mean, the desertification in Africa has been going on for over 20 years at least.
Yep.
We have good evidence now the oceans having been acidified. A lot of the plankton are in danger of actually collapsing, and if they go, pretty much everything goes, because everything depends ultimately on plankton, animals, and plants.
And most of the coral is already gone.
The coral is gone. I mean, you have the barrier reef in Australia. I mean, it's at least two-thirds gone. If the emissions rate is over 350 parts per million in terms of carbon dioxide for over 10 years, I mean, the question is, how long will the ecosystem as a whole, have time to survive?
Right.
So people who argue about this aren't really being scientific at all, and we need to all come together, frankly, even people in the industry, to pretty much save the planet, in my opinion.
Yeah, very well said, Tim. Thank you very much. Absolutely, absolutely. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard.
Hey, to add to that library situation, all books will be stored upside down so George can read them without having to flip them.
And they're all picture books.
Yeah, I've got a theory. I'm wondering if you've ever run into this. But if you take a perfect vacuum, if you had a thermos bottle and a perfect vacuum and you heated it, the temperature would never drop. And I believe the world, the Earth, is in a perfect vacuum called outer space.
And well, actually, if you had a perfect vacuum, the temperature would never go up because I mean, you could have radio.
No, if you had a source to heat it.
You have to have particles that are vibrating, and that heat is contained as kinetic energy. And so in a perfect vacuum, you have no particles. So you could have waves passing through it, but you'd have nothing in the vacuum actually holding the heat.
Well, let me change the premise slightly. If you had that perfect vacuum in a thermos bottle and a heat source within the liquid in the thermos bottle, and you heated that liquid, that temperature would remain constant. It would never drop. I'm only using this as an analogy for the Earth being in a perfect vacuum, which is outer space. And for every gallon of gasoline that's burnt, we increase the temperature of the Earth.
Right.
Where does that heat go?
Yeah, well, where it's going is it's increasingly going into the Earth's crust and the Earth's, the physical mass. I mean, the Earth is warming, the land is warming, the atmosphere is warming, the oceans are warming, okay, your metaphor. I get your metaphor. And excellent point. Thank you, Howard. It's here, and it ain't going. It's not being radiated out into space. And in fact, one of the problems is as you increase the pollution levels, look at the air over China, right? You increase the pollution levels, you decrease the rate at which heat might be radiated into outer space. On the other hand, in some areas, you increase the pollution levels, like happened after the big volcano. Where was that? This was back 30 years ago or so ago, and there was another one in the 19th century. You get volcanic eruptions, and it'll cool the Earth down for a year or so because it throws a bunch of particles up that reflect the sunlight. But these are anomalous events. Colleen in Seattle. Hey, Colleen.
Hello. Yes, I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
But I just wanted to make a point. The last guest that you had on made a comment, and he used the blizzards in China as an example of cooling, when actually blizzards would be an example of warming. It takes warm air colliding with cold air to make moisture, which is energy. So the more moisture you have in the air, the more you're going to have blizzards.
Yeah, excellent point.
It's warm air.
Yeah, excellent point. And then the blizzards are containing the moisture, which is precipitating out of the clouds, which is which got there because of evaporation and is moving around because of global instability and thermal instability. Yes, absolutely. Joe in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the credibility of Bill Gray. I was at a party a couple months ago, and I was talking to a postdoc researcher.
If I could just pause you for a second, Joe. Mr. Gray is the scientist who was being cited by our guest 30 minutes ago, for those people who may have just tuned in, the scientist who says there's no such thing as global warming, or words to that effect. Continue.
So, actually, I was talking to a postdoc researcher at the Atmospheric Science Department at Colorado State University, and he told me everyone there is really frustrated with Bill Gray. He's a professor emeritus and basically just hasn't kept up on the research that's in disagreement with his idea about global warming.
Yeah. It's in any field you're going to find some folks who are dispositionally, predisposed to be contrarians, or, who love the spotlight of being contrarians, or who like the little extra cash they get from ExxonMobil or whatever. I mean, there's still an Earth is flat society out there, for heaven's sake. But that doesn't mean that these guys should be setting public policy. Joe, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Richard in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Richard.
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
First time talking on a talk show. I'm glad it was you. You're the best.
Well, thank you.
Anyways, I'm an old retired sailor, and I used to fly an ice patrol out of Maryland. We go up to the Arctic and the Antarctic, and we draw ice charts to help shipping get through for less amount of damage. And I'd be curious today what it would be like this many years later if we could somehow, the Oceanographic Office in Central Maryland has all kinds of charts, everything we did, the people before me and the people after me. Mm. I'm just curious what it looks like today, because I don't think we do this any longer.
Yeah,
it would be interesting.
Well, what we know is that during the summer periods now, we're looking at an Arctic that, just 3 years ago, they were predicting in 20 years the Arctic would be ice-free, and now it looks like it might be this year or next year. I mean, this global warming is happening so much more rapidly than anybody had expected. Huge chunks of ice falling off, the ice sheets, the Larsen A and B sheets and whatnot in Antarctica. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. Richard, thank you for pointing that out. Appreciate the call. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
I'm calling from Denver. It just set a record for most days over 90 degrees, and the rainfall is down by about 70% this year. So we're shattering the old records on heat and drought.
Oh, my.
Nearby Oklahoma, by the way, is drier than the Dust Bowl days.
Yeah, and look at all the wildfires in California.
Yeah, so four quick points. One is, as one person said, don't let snowfall be allowed to be used as a sign of global cooling. It does tend to increase with warming. Antarctica is a desert, and they've recently been having blizzards down there. Cold places tend to be drier in many cases.
Right.
Also, right now, everybody is listening, stop calling it global warming. Call it global climate change, because it's not linear. It's going to be uneven. Some places are going to get colder. Some places are going to get much warmer. It's the average temperature.
Right.
So global climate change will help diffuse a lot of that stuff. Like, say, well, look, it's getting colder there. Europe may get, we've already been predicting Europe may get much, much colder.
Right. Well, that was my point to Dan when he started talking about blizzards. I said, that's why they call it climate change.
Also, the melting of a lot of the ice sheets will be putting some very cold water into the oceans.
Right.
Also, it's not going to be linear. There are going to be periods that are going to be getting warmer and colder. You're going to get perhaps very much in certain areas, you're going to get increased cloud cover that could be both cooling and warming, depending on where it is. And if you were to, anyone who kayaks who's been through flooding, you'll see you get something called funny water when you get a flood. And because the river is not used to that level of flowing, you'll find very strange up currents, also think currents that are going the wrong way and so forth. Because of that. So, the Earth is not adapted to the new changes here.
No, and in fact, the huge concern is that the large amounts of glacial melt coming off Greenland are going to dump enough fresh, cold water into the North Atlantic that it'll shut down the Great Conveyor Belt.
And everyone on this should also take a look at latent heat.
Yeah,
latent heat is a big factor in this.
Yeah, and within 1 year now, we've just learned, within 1 year, if the Great Conveyor Belt shuts down, then most of Northern Europe, what is currently, you know, the home to over 800 million people, will become, 14 feet of ice year-round.
And by the way, you were trying to think of Mount Pinatubo, I believe.
Mount Pinatubo. Yes, thank you very much.
That was in the late 80s, and as a photographer, it really affected us. We lost a lot of good shots that year because of the world was affected by, we had bad sunsets.
You're absolutely right. Jeff, thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to us there in Denver. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at hartmanradio.com.
Tom Hartman with you. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's see. It's 10 minutes before 10 here on the West Coast. That'd be 10 minutes before 1 on the East Coast. And you can figure out in between. Craig in San Luis Obispo. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'd just like to point out that we've been here before with this argument. Just a different name. At the turn of the century during the industrial age, there was the rule of thought was that we cannot affect the waterways and the oceans with any pollution that we might create. And it took so much money to try and clean this up. Wouldn't it be wiser just to err on the side of caution?
You would think so. And, in fact, that was originally John McCain's suggestion, if you'll recall. He was saying, if we're wrong, we got a little cleaner environment. If we're right, then we've saved the world. And
not bad.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It just seems like the rational way to go about it. Craig, very well said. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening on KYNS. Let's see here. Ben in Winnipeg, Canada. You want to disagree with me? Craig? Ben? No, Ben. Okay. How about Dick in Seattle?
Yeah, Tom, I think it's a little facetious to try and make this argument about whether or not, we have a global warming issue to try to discredit those who deny human-induced CO2 global warming as the primary cause. I mean, given the geologic history that we know, including a warmer period around 2400 BC, I think the more likely explanation has to relate to orbital and solar forcing issues. But, all these...
Yeah, there's a consensus
issues...
about that, Dick.
Pardon me?
There's absolutely agreement in the scientific community that solar forcing is one of the variables here. It's just that it's only about, best guess, according to the IPCC, somewhere between 13 and 20% of the variable.
Well, we don't know enough about it. That's the problem. And all these...
It's measurable.
Issues. They have incomplete, if not inadequate, data to create accurate computer models, which are
measurable. You can measure the. We've got satellites all over the place measuring the output of the solar output.
Well,
the fact of the matter is that most of the planets in the solar system that we can measure are getting slightly warmer right now because because solar radiation has increased, and so is the Earth. The problem is that we're amplifying that. You can't go from 260 parts per billion in the of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to 370 parts per billion and not have a change.
And we know heat causes greenhouse gases to increase. And we know those greenhouse gases tend to follow the warming patterns.
The principal increase, if you're saying that the heat causes water vapor to increase, yes, and water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but heat, but carbon dioxide, no, actually heat should cause carbon dioxide to decrease because plant activity absorbs carbon dioxide and releases oxygen. Instead, what we're seeing is carbon dioxide increasing as a consequence of burning fossil fuels. We've converted a trillion barrels of oil into, by and large, atmospheric carbon. Very little of it is land-based. About all of the stuff that's land-based is in the form of plastics. Most of it's gone into the air.
Well, if you're wrong, then we're stuck with the solutions you're coming up with, which aren't going to help and do create problems. If you're right, then
what solutions
all the better,
of mine are you saying that won't work?
There's a downside to being wrong, is what I'm trying to say. We have to have good science here. We have incomplete and inadequate science.
So let's just wait.
No, let's do better science. There's more to be learned. The debate has to go on. And we need to do less character assassination.
I'm sorry, Dick. There's no need for a debate to go on. We know that we have a problem here. I mean, this is a full-bore disaster. You can travel anywhere around the world where you can see the results of this. This is killing people right now.
We don't know what's causing it. That's the problem.
We have an effect on it. We do know that our carbon dioxide emissions are having a substantial and measurable and probably the primary effect. Even if it's not the primary effect, even if it's a secondary effect, let's stop it. And not only that, if we cut back on our carbon dioxide emissions, particularly those coming from oil, we stop giving money to Saudi Arabia. Tell me the downside of that.
Let's not corrupt the science and the process and use character assassination to force people to our point of thinking.
What's the character assassination
point? Well, it goes on constantly. It's just the simple fact of pointing out some people deny global warming. That's an example of it. There's no real denial about that. We're trying to figure out what causes it. And the best scientific evidence I've seen is solar forcing and orbital forcing.
Now, the character assassination that I'm hearing, Dick, from guys on your side is that Al Gore is just doing this, or scientists are just doing this because they want to get another grant. They want to make more money. They think
that's where the money is right now.
Yes, exactly. That is character assassination. Dick, thanks a lot, but I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. Bikash in San Rafael. Hey, Bikash.
Hi, this is my first time calling, so I'm a little nervous right now.
That's okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I love your show. I listen every day.
Thank you.
I moved here 5 years ago, and I'm from Nepal. And
from Nepal?
Yeah.
Okay,
and some of my friends climbed Mount Everest, and some of my friends says that ice is melting there, and some of my friends are getting injured almost all the time because the rocks falling down.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no ice left on Mount Everest, you know?
Yeah, we just had a couple of climbers die on K2, which is the second highest peak in the world, and as a result of boulders falling down them, and maybe it's because they weren't locked up in ice. Yeah, go ahead.
And then I just had my friends just broke a couple of legs because the rock fell down from the top.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all my comment on it. Global warming is definitely happening right now, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is. Thanks, Bikash. I appreciate the call. And, you know, from somebody who's been there, seen it, and done that. So, by the way, speaking of K2, I've been reading this book. I was reading it on my last trip, Three Cups of Tea. You got to read this book, Three Cups of Tea. And it is just extraordinary, the story of this guy who is now building schools in Pakistan. And this is, you know, you want to, quote, fight terrorism? The way to fight terrorism is not to drop bombs on people. It's to build schools and hospitals for them. It's to provide a better quality of living for them. It's to help them become self-sufficient. And it's a whole lot cheaper than dropping bombs on them. And this book is just a brilliant example of it. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Michael Tanner from the Cato Institute. We're going to talk about universal health care coverage. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, what do we do about health insurance? Welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour, second hour. Michael Tanner is with me. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, cato.org, the website. And Michael has been involved in a whole variety of different types of research. His most recent book, Leviathan on the Right, How Big Government Conservatism Brought Down the Republican Revolution. Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Let's define some terms here, if we can, for the purposes of this discussion, because I'm concerned that these terms just get lost in the way. How would you define insurance?
Insurance is a risk spreading mechanism. It's designed to take things that have a high cost but low likelihood of occurring and to spread those costs over a larger population.
Right. Okay. I absolutely agree with that. And government in the United States, our constitutionally limited democratic republic, what would you define as the principal purpose of that?
I think the principal purposes of any government are to defend life, liberty, and justly acquired property.
Okay. You're going back to John Locke's version. Thomas Jefferson took life, liberty, and property and changed it into life, liberty, and happiness. But we'll go with Locke's version. The first word is life. Isn't life, I mean, how can you have life if you are sick and you don't have access to healthcare services? And how can you have insurance that actually functions if the largest possible pool, which would be all of the people in the United States, is not, you know, isn't included in that pool? And if the insurance is being run for profit rather than for the purposes of distributing and reducing risk?
Well, I think you raised a couple of good questions. The first thing, though, is I think you're conflating several different things. The idea that health is the same as access to health care, as is the same as access to health insurance, those things are not necessarily the same thing. Many places around the world give you a piece of paper that says you have health insurance, but you don't necessarily get access to health care.
For example?
For example, in Britain, under the National Health Service, many places in Canada. Now, some places do have national health care systems that don't limit access, but some do.
Well, in all of those places, if you have a serious illness, you're going to get immediate attention. If you want to have a nose job or a boob job, it's going to take you a while.
Well, no, it's not just...
Or even a hip replacement.
It's not just that type of care. It is, in many cases, it is serious care. For example, under cancer, in the National Health Service in Britain, only about 40% of people ever get to see an oncologist. About 50,000 surgeries are canceled every year because the patient became too sick on the waiting list to receive access to care. And it's also in Canada, it's...
Well, there's a lot of people who don't get surgery in the United States for Canada.
My son-in-law's
mother is going through that right now. She's it's too far advanced. She can't have surgery.
Yeah.
We're playing with figures here, Michael.
My argument is that saying you have health insurance does not guarantee you access to health care.
Right, exactly. Ask anybody in America who has health insurance.
Right. So the question isn't whether or not we give everyone in America a piece of paper that says they have health insurance. The question is, what can we do to ensure that more people have access to health care? And even more important than just whether or not we want people to have access to health care is whether or not we want people to have better health. And where is the maximum effectiveness with the limited amount of finances we have to do those things? And there is no evidence in any of the academic literature that providing more health insurance is a better way to ensure access or a better way to ensure health than other uses of that money.
So you're saying that the people who don't have health insurance, here we have Newsweek running this story about doctors within borders, this organization that is going into, it's called RAM, R-A-M, it stands for Remote Area Medical. And they're going into areas where people have no health insurance because they're poor. There's 1,800 volunteer doctors. They just in one area in Appalachia, a white community, in fact, they extracted 3,800 painfully decayed teeth, administered 156 mammograms, screened hundreds of people for diabetes and heart disease, gave out 1,000 pairs of eyeglasses. This is just fundamental, basic, bottom line healthcare stuff that people couldn't get because they didn't have health insurance.
No, I am suggesting that all things considered, it is better to be insured than to be uninsured.
Right.
And
so
we can do things to try to lower the cost of insurance and get more people insurance. But if you have limited amounts of finances, whether or not the best answer is to provide people with insurance with those finances, or whether or not you can be more effective in ensuring health care by doing other things, such as directly providing them with eyeglasses or building clinics in low-income neighborhoods that provide free care to people who walk in, that may be a more effective way of using
that. Are you talking about government-owned clinics?
Pardon?
Are you talking about socialism? You're talking about the British system, government-owned clinics?
I'm talking about if you want to have free clinics that provide walk-in care to people who have emergencies.
Oh, you mean if Bill Gates decides to be a philanthropist, if a wealthy person decides to set something up for free? You're not talking about something funded by you and me.
That may be a more effective use of the money than simply providing universal health insurance.
We're talking with Michael Tanner, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. When I was a kid growing up in Michigan, I actually remember doctors coming to the house, house visits. And I also remember that the law was the Blue Cross Blue Shield, which was the health insurance that my dad had because he worked in a union shop, a tool and die shop, they were required to be a not-for-profit corporation. So the CEO wasn't making millions, and there were no stockholders who were making money on it, and they were very, very efficient at delivering health care. All the hospitals, I was born in a hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that was owned by the county. When I grew up in Lansing, I usually went to Ingham Medical, which was the county hospital there. There was also a Catholic-run hospital, but the hospitals all had to be non-for-profit, and the health insurance companies all had to be not-for-profit, and the system worked pretty well. And then Reagan came along and said, hey, let's help some people make some bucks on health care. Bill Frist's daddy became one of the 10 richest men in America, became a multi-billionaire, flipping non-profit hospitals into for-profit and squeezing the blood out of people, literally. And now we have a system where 20-30% of all healthcare dollars are going into the pockets of millionaires and billionaires. How can you defend that?
Well, first of all, I would suggest there still are a number of nonprofit insurers that are out there. The Kaiser, for example, is a nonprofit. A lot of the mutual insurance companies are nonprofits. That said, the average margin of profit for an insurer is between 3-5%.
That's profit after the huge CEO salaries, after the distributions of dividends, after everything else. I mean, you're talking about the profit on which they're paying taxes.
I'm talking about their actual profit.
Why should there be any distribution of dividend to stockholders? Why should there be any profit that's taxable? Why should there be any CEOs making 20, 30, 50? Yeah, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, United Healthcare, they paid William McGuire, their CEO, $1.78 billion, and we wouldn't have even known about it if the Wall Street Journal hadn't outed it on the front page.
Well, and I'm not going to make any brief for executive salaries, but he paid taxes on that. The shareholders obviously felt that what he was doing was providing a certain level of benefit for that amount of money. And, I'll leave that up to the shareholders of his company to whether or not he's worth it.
Well, they're making money too. The people who are getting screwed are the people who are insured. This is a system that is designed to make money, and we should have a healthcare system that is designed to make health. And that in my mind means we should have a system where we distribute the risk among the greatest number of people. Let's have Medicare for all. Let's just say anybody in America can sign up for Medicare.
Well, Medicare has hardly done an overwhelmingly successful job. It is a program that is some $70 trillion in debt going forward. It is a program that by and
large... It is not in debt right now. You're talking about future liabilities and projected
future revenues.
Future
liabilities going forward.
But right at the moment, it's doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, right now it is actually running a deficit. But if going forward, it is unlike Social Security, which is running a surplus right now. Medicare is actually running a deficit today and is being supplemented by general revenues. But that aside, Medicare is facing enormous unfunded liabilities going forward. The quality of care that it provides is generally rated as mediocre. And
I don't disagree, and that's why I say if everybody in America, if every single voter turned to Medicare for their services, do you really think that anybody would be, every 2 years we have elections, do you really think that any of these politicians would say, yeah, we'll just let it be mediocre?
Yeah, I think that the politicians have an overwhelming incentive to provide care for the vast majority of people who are not terribly sick, and to skimp on care for the people who are really sick, who cost the most.
Yeah, well, that doesn't seem to be the experience of the majority of developed countries, but anyhow, I guess it's more of a philosophical discussion at that level. You can read all about it over at the Cato Institute, cato.org. Michael Tanner, senior fellow there. Michael, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This This is Tom Hartmann.
Corporations would really rather you didn't know. Welcome to the Tom Hartmann program. Okay, let's see what you get when you get a for-profit health industry. An industry whose first goal is to make money. And the way that they happen to do it is rather than selling tobacco or making plastic products or making cars or running a railroad, they happen to do it by providing health care. But their first goal is to make money. And a tip of the hat to Shroom Duke in the chat room. If you go over to TAF.org, the TAF, the Taxpayers Against Fraud Education Fund, and you look at their False Claims Act Legal Center, let's just take a look at this. Some of the top false claims. Tenet Healthcare, July 2006. They agreed to pay $900 million to the federal government for billing violations that included manipulation of outlier payments to Medicare, as well as kickbacks, upcoding, and bill padding. HCA, the healthcare company formerly known as Columbia HCA, the largest for-profit hospital chain. I believe this is the one Bill Frist's daddy owned. $731,400,000 in fines that they agreed to pay under the False Claims Act. HCA, again, $631 million. This is from June of 2003 under the False Claims Act. How could Bill Frist even hold his seat? Anyway, Serono, in October of 2005, Serono agreed to pay $704 million to settle a fraud case involving a human growth product used to fight AIDS-related wasting. His charges involve kickbacks to doctors, kickbacks to specialist pharmacies, illegal off-label marketing of the drug, non-FDA-approved diagnosis equipment designed to spur more prescriptions for the drug, and it cost as much as $20,000 for a three-month regime. Of the $704 million settlement, $567 million is earmarked to settle federal and state claims. $136 million paid as a related criminal fine. Yet the corporation is not in jail. Corporations don't go to jail, you know. Takeda Abbott Pharmaceutical Products, $559,483,560 under the False Claims Act. Schering Plough, $255 million under the False Claims Act. This is they originally agreed to pay $435 million. Abbott Labs, in July of 2003, a unit of Abbott Laboratories pled guilty to obstructing a criminal investigation and defrauding the Medicare and Medicaid programs and agreed to pay $400 million to resolve civil claims. In addition, a subsidiary of Abbott Labs, CG Nutritionals, agreed to a criminal fine of $200 million. Fresenius Medical Care of North America, National Medicare, $385 million under the False Claims Act. Amerigroup, $334 million under the... These are just the ones who got caught. And then after they got caught, got successfully prosecuted. And then after they got successfully prosecuted, a judge said, or a jury said, here's how much you have to pay. Bristol-Myers Squibb agreed to pay $515 million to settle allegations brought in seven QI-TAM cases, six in Boston, one in Florida, involving pricing and promotional activities, including kickbacks to doctors for more than 50 drugs, including 13 drugs with a combined 2007 sales of $10.7 billion. They paid a $328 million fine. This is just, yeah, it's just the cost of doing business. Drugs included Plavix, the blood thinner, Abilify, the antipsychotic, the cholesterol treatment, Provacol, the cancer therapy, Taxol, and the antidepressant Cerazone. Of the $515 million, approximately $328 million would be paid under the Federal False Claims Act. SmithKline Beecham. In March of 1997, SmithKline Beecham Clinical Laboratories, Inc. was ordered to pay $325 million for filing of false claims related to laboratory tests, paid for in whole or in part by the federal government. Your and my tax dollars. Hard at work. HealthSouth. In December of 2004, HealthSouth Corporation, the nation's largest provider of rehabilitative medical services, agreed to pay the United States $325 million to settle allegations that the company systematically defrauded Medicare and other federal health care systems. National Medical Enterprises. NME agreed to pay $379 million in criminal fines, civil damages, and penalties for kickbacks and fraud at psychiatric and substance abuse hospitals in more than 30 states. Gambro Healthcare, $310 million under the False Claims Act. Sharing Plow, $292,969,482 under the False Claims Act. AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, $266,127,844 under the False Claims Act. St. Barnabas Hospitals, $265 million under the False Claims Act. Bayer Corporation, $257,200,000 under the False Claims Act. And on, ago. I mean, this is just the beginning of a list of over 100 of them. Laboratory Corporation of America, $182 million. Isn't it time to get the profit out of health care?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Indeed, time for change, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. And believe it or not, our full Monty alert for the day.
Better take off your coat.
Involves John McCain.
Real slow.
And Cindy.
Better take off your shoes.
You see, they were in South Dakota. At the Miss Buffalo Chip Contest.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can leave your hat on.
Yeah, you can leave your hat on, but ESPN's Jim Capel described it as essentially a topless beauty pageant and occasionally bottomless, too. Yesterday evening, John McCain took part in the Sturgis Rally 2008 at Buffalo Chip in South Dakota, an annual tribute to veterans. The candidate was so enthused. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he'd had a few beers. He told attendees that he encouraged his wife to participate in the festivities. I told her with a little luck she'd be the only woman ever to serve as both the First Lady and Miss Buffalo Chip.
That's right.
During a drenching rain Wednesday night, the contest broke up into smaller groups, and one woman wound up dancing naked on a bar top. Her husband saw her and angrily dragged her away as she struggled to put her pants back on, muttering something about, "It's only one week a year!" Yeah. No, that wasn't Cindy who did that. She's reformed her behavior, I'd say, over the years. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Should health care be a right or a privilege? I think that's the bottom line, ultimately. Is health care part of the commons? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you can't have health care? I think this is not rocket science. I think it should be considered part of our commons. Bill in Seattle. Hey, Bill, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, Tom. Your show is such a great source of news that I can't get anyplace else. I can get it from monthlies, but not daily.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Thank you.
I just wanted to say that my daughter actually was an illegal immigrant. She went to the Netherlands with a guy that had dual citizenship, and you know, she got better health care in the Netherlands as an illegal immigrant, and they knew she was one, than she got in this country as a fully enrolled member of an HMO. Her co-pays were less. Her treatment was better. It was just pretty amazing. But at the same time, she couldn't get a job because they were looking out for and not letting illegal immigrants take jobs over there.
Yeah, no, it's very, you know, as you may know, I lived in Germany for a year, and during part of that time, I was working with a charity that I've Kindering Jugend Hilfswerk Salem. SalemInternational.org is the website. And in order for me to work with that charity, I had to go through a huge 3-month song and dance before we left to get a visa, to get a work visa so that I could be there. They will throw your butt in jail if they discover that you're working without permission.
Absolutely.
Anywhere.
Absolutely.
In Europe. Yeah. But on the other hand, the healthcare was spectacular. And that's what, you know, the sick, and Bill, thank you very much. The sick man of Europe in terms of healthcare is England. The United Kingdom has arguably the worst health care in the UK. Why? Because of Margaret Thatcher. Because Margaret Thatcher tried to privatize the health care system, tried to destroy the health care system in the UK. She was, you know, Reaganomics, Thatcheronomics. And the legacy of it is it's a disaster. I mean, it's a disaster that's a whole lot better than what we have here. You talk to Brits and they, you know, hey, do you want nothing at all? But it's still, I mean, I always find it interesting that whenever you debate national health care with people, they don't want to debate about the Danish system or the Norwegian system or the Swedish system or the French system, which arguably is the best in the world. In Denmark, in fact, they're having a debate about whether they should adopt the French system because they think it's a little better. Nobody wants the British system. So, Fred in Monmouth, Oregon. Hey, Fred.
Hey. I've noticed that when you talk to opponents of universal health care, and you ask them about these other countries, they say, I'm not familiar with that, and move on and change the subject.
Yeah, by and large, this is the tragedy. Most Americans don't have a passport. Most Americans have never been outside the United States. Most Americans have never used these health care systems. I remember, my first experience with the British health care system was maybe 15 years ago or so. I was in London giving a speech at King's College, as I recall. And it was I had a book out about attention deficit disorder that had just been published in the UK. And Louise was with me, and the youngest of our three kids, we were homeschooling her at the time, and she was with us. And she had this god-awful ear infection, and we got back from the speech about 11 o'clock at night, and she was in a lot of pain. And we were staying with a family of some friends of ours there. And so the family, the local folks said, oh, well, you know, we'll just call the local surgery, which is like the local doctor's office. And it was just like two, three blocks down the road. And it's, you know, kind of a little dock in the box place. She called and I talked with the guy and I described the symptoms. And he says, yeah, I'll come right over. And I'm like, come right over? It's almost midnight. He says, yeah, in fact, he says, you know, I'm about to end my shift, so it's really easy. I'll just drop by. So he comes over, and we say, you know, shall we get her out? She's, you know, she's in bed right now. He's like, no, don't disturb her. You know, we'll all just go in there. And so we all go into the bedroom, and, you know, she's there under the blankets. And he says, you know, let me see your ear here. And he's looking in her ear with the otoscope. And he says, yep, you know, she's got a pretty bad infection there. And he opens the box and says, here's some antibiotics. This should take care of it. And, you know, in the morning, here's a prescription you can take to a pharmacy and they'll give you the whole course and everything will be fine. And I said, this is incredible. What do I owe you? He said, you don't owe me anything. And I mean, it's like, I don't owe you anything. No, you know, he says, if you were British, I'd give you some paperwork to fill out. But, you know, you're not. So it's more hassle than it's worth. So, you know, I'm just pleased to do it. And you get people who go into medicine because they care about medicine. That's amazing. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for humoring me yet again.
Okay.
I just wanted to – one of the things that really is interesting is there's always this anecdotal so-and-so died of cancer and, you know, the tragic human issues that do make it personal, that humanize it, that bring out the compassionate. But there's always this – when you get caught up in the personal side of it, you sometimes overlook mentioning that the statistics don't lie. If you look at the charts for healthcare, infant mortality, cancer rates, life expectancy. We're way down there. If our system was
working, down there with third world countries.
We're
it is absolutely, you're spot on, Richard. We are a basket case worldwide. Thank you for the call, Richard. Point made and well made. Matt in New Jersey. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. I just heard about a case yesterday on the radio. In New York, the hospitals are being sued for discriminating against people who have Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
Now, apparently, if you have private insurance and public insurance, you have two different systems of care.
Yeah, that's right. And again, this goes back to 30 years of right-wing ideology, the Bush administration doing a fine job of trying to destroy Medicare. This, what these guys do, because they so, and thank you for the point, they so hate government. I mean, you know, remember Ronald Reagan.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And, you know, that, and of course, so let's take apart anything that the government might do that's good, right?
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, we're going to destroy Medicare. We're going to destroy Social Security. We're going to destroy unemployment insurance. We're going to destroy progressive income tax. We're going to, you know, on and on it goes, right? We know what the right-wing agenda is. And a good chunk of that, like you saw with FEMA down in New Orleans, is you break government, and then you point to it and say, look, it's broken. Let's find a private contractor, or preferably a buddy of ours, a campaign donor. How about Halliburton? How about Blackwater? Let's find a private contractor to do it instead. Van in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Van.
Hey, how's it going? I wanted to comment. A great show. Reflect your comments as well. I was in England a few times. My mom lived there, and several times I needed to go in, and I got immediate care and very little stuff. They just asked if she was a member of the National Health, and that took care of all of it.
Yeah. And you can just literally walk in off the street, you know, and see a doctor within. Well, I did it once. I had just a god-awful cold. I thought it was becoming pneumonia, and I just walked in off the street to one of these surgeries. This is maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. And, you know, 15 minutes in the waiting room, and I was seeing a doctor.
Yeah, they did stitches. They had to look up poison oak because they'd never had any familiarity with it, but they knew exactly what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, tons of times. But what I want to say is I believe it ought to be nationalized. In fact, I think we're responsible for doing that on a global level. I mean, we're human beings. We need to evolve into something that's better. But what I wanted to ask was my dad was telling me, he was a political scientist a few years back, and he was talking about how corporations must meet a public good, public good.
Right.
And apparently they used to have to go up for relicensing every 2 years. I guess this was like maybe 100 years back.
Yes, and this all ended in the late 1880s and 1890s. I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection. It's also
cool.
My book, We the People. And yes, it used to be that if you wanted to start a corporation, your first purpose for existence had to be to serve the public good, and your second purpose had to be, you know, to run a railroad and make a profit. And every 2 years, the Secretary of State or whatever state you were incorporated in had to determine whether or not you were serving the public good. And if not, you got your charter pulled.
I think we need to
go back to that, Van. I think we absolutely need to go back to that. With regard to things like nationalizing companies, I'm not a big fan of that. I don't want a so-called socialist system where the government owns the hospitals and like in Britain. I would rather see a single-payer healthcare system and not-for-profit hospitals.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Forming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Benny in Idaho. Hey, Benny, thanks for waiting so long online there. What's up?
Hello, how you doing? Yeah, I was had something that I was really concerned about, and that was Obama's numbers going down.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's been kind of blaming it on the negative ads of McCain, but I think it's something else, and I think we need to counter. And what I think it is I think it is millions of Swift boat emails going out to
everybody. I agree. I think there is a massive email campaign, millions of them a day going out. And, in fact, if you go over to Snopes.com and you look at, you know, the top urban myths, Obama is at the top of the list. And then he's got a list of all the lies, all the email lies that are out there that are floating around about Obama. And it's just amazing. The most recent one I got this last night, was Obama's airplane, right? It's got the logo for his campaign on the plane, on the tail of the plane. And it says, oh my God, this is un-American. He's got the logo of his campaign on the tail of his plane. This is a terrible thing. Why not the American flag? This guy's unpatriotic. Can you believe it? And just, you know, this incredible outrage. And so I went to Snopes.com, and yeah, he does have the logo for the Obama campaign on the tail of the airplane. And when you look at the John McCain plane, and by the way, the logo is red, white, and blue, and it's stripes, right? When you go to the John McCain plane, it's blue and gold, and it says johnmccain.com. And so, you know, neither of the planes has a flag on its tail, but that's, you know, this viral email that goes out to millions and millions of people. This is just today's. Every single day. This is Don Segretti on steroids. This is Karl Rove on steroids. This is the exact same thing. And Benny, thanks for pointing it out. This is the exact same thing that was done against John McCain in South Carolina with the push polls, where they were calling up people, registered Republicans, and saying, hey, did you know that John McCain has a dark-skinned daughter and that she's the result of his having an affair out of wedlock with an African-American woman? And actually, they didn't even say, do you know that? They said, if you knew that, would it change how you vote? In other words, they didn't assert it as a fact. They posited it as a hypothetical question. So it was legal. And the fact of the matter is that he does have a dark-skinned child because his wife adopted her from Bangladesh. And, you know, Cindy McCain was over there. She saw this little girl in terrible straits and brought her home, adopted her. I mean, this was the scurrilous charge and so now the McCain camp has adopted the exact same kind of strategy. Or people, you know, we can't say it's the McCain camp. The guys on the right, I just don't know how to say it beyond that. Blair in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Blair, what's up?
How you doing? First-time caller.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Listened to you for a long time. Read many of your books. Very impressed.
Well, thank you.
Quick comment. Your question, is healthcare a right or a privilege? I think the question is more, is life a right or a privilege? But I'm going to let you answer that, but I'm going to answer one thing. I'm going to say, it's a privilege to be talking to you.
Well,
that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Thank you, Blair. I appreciate the call. I would say that healthcare should be considered a right. I mean, the Declaration of Independence, which is not a legal document in the United States, but nonetheless defines life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution, which is a legal document, the preamble to the Constitution, you know, opens right up, again, repeating that we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and I would say health is included in that, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. And in fact, James Madison, the 1, 2, 3, 4th president of the United States, his first veto was vetoing legislation that would give money to a church in Washington, D.C. to provide health care and housing and food to the poor and homeless, to the destitute. And he vetoed it not because he didn't think it was a function of government, but because he didn't think it was a function of churches. He didn't want the money going to a church. And you can still read his veto address, and in that veto address he said this should be a, I'm paraphrasing now, that this should be a function of government to care for the poor and the destitute, to feed and house people. It should not be a function of churches. And if we give money to churches, we're going to corrupt the churches. And if we get in bed with the churches, it's ultimately going to corrupt us. But from its founding, this country has cared for people who didn't have health care. From its founding. Frank in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Frank.
Hey. I just wanted to say that I think that the more advanced and civilized a society, the more the benefits to its members arise from rights realized, not privileges obtained or, transferred. And likewise, the opposite, the more primitive a society, it's based on privilege and inheritance and things like that.
Yeah.
It's socially, it may sound like socialism to you, whether hospitals are socialized, nationalized, but I do believe the inherent control of a an entity, an institution that is as open and open for control instead of closed by some sort of private ownership is not compatible. It is a conflict of interest in something that is to be seen as a right.
You know, we need
privilege.
To redeem the word socialist, Frank. You just used it. I like our socialist police departments. I like our socialist fire departments. I like our socialist public education system. I like our socialist stop signs and red lights and you know, traffic control systems. I like our socialist national highway system. I like our socialist air traffic control system. These are all literally socialist programs. Let's redeem the word. It's an idea. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Congresswoman Diane DeJet. I'm not sure. We'll find out how to pronounce it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And we have with us at the moment Congresswoman Diana DeGette. She is the author of, first of all, she represents Congresswoman from Colorado. DeGette, D-E-G-E-T-T-E dot house.gov. Congresswoman, what is the district that you represent?
I represent the 1st District of Colorado, which is Denver, where the entire Democratic National Convention will be held.
Great, and where we're on the air. And on M760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. And,
exactly.
And your new book, Sex, Science, and Stem Cells, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason. This is just an absolutely marvelous book. I salute you for the enormous amount of effort that went into this. You write in the book about how you had once been a volunteer lawyer for the ACLU. And
that's right.
Tell me just very briefly about that, and then let's get into the book.
Well, I when I first came back to Denver from law school, I got involved in representing clients, and I also wanted to do public interest law. So I volunteered for the ACLU. I did all kinds of different cases. One time I represented a group of black Muslims down at the prison who had been denied their rights to exercise their religion and all kinds of other cases. They were all always very interesting.
Yeah, it must have been a fascinating education or kind of post-education insight,
exactly.
Shall we say. And now this book. Here, the candidates on stem cell research, for example, which is one small piece of your book overall. John McCain opposes embryonic stem cell research that uses cloned human embryos. In 2006, he supported a trio of U.S. Senate bills designed to increase federal funding for stem cell research, ban the creation of embryos for research, and offer federal support for research. In 2007, He voted, well, in any case, he's basically now, he's taking the position he's opposed to this stuff. Barack Obama supports relaxing federal restrictions on embryonic stem cell research and voted for the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005, which was actually passed by Congress and vetoed by a Republican Congress and vetoed by George W. Bush.
Right, that was my bill.
That was your bill?
Yeah, all those bills were my, well, not all of them, but the expansion of the stem cell research, the bills that President Bush vetoed, not once but twice. I was the prime House sponsor of those bills and, frankly, the architect of that legislation.
That is great. Congresswoman DeGette, tell us, what's the deal with this? I mean, literally, your subtitle, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason. This goes beyond logic, and I would argue in many ways it actually even goes beyond religion.
It does, Tom. I mean, for one thing, I personally am quite religious. I go to church every Sunday and sing in my church choir. But what this is about is the thorough politicization of science by the right wing of any issue relating to sex or reproduction. And I'm not just talking about stem cells, although I have been the chief proponent pushing that through, but I'm also talking about international HIV/AIDS policy. I'm talking about abstinence-only birth control and issues that really most Americans would think we've gotten beyond in this country, completely politicized by the right wing. We even have refused to give Plan B, which is birth control, to our troops in the formulary on the front lines. And so what I did is I set out to write this book to let the voters know as the fall elections approach that they really need to look in depth at their candidates to say who is supporting sound research when they're making public policy. Because after all, when you have bad policies like this, it not only wastes tens of millions of dollars, it also is very, very bad for public health.
The guy that the Bush administration put in charge of women's issues and reproductive health issues used to rape his wife and leave a $100 bill on the bedroom dresser. You're familiar with the story?
No.
I don't have his name in front of me. It was a big scandal about a year and a half ago, and he resigned. But yes, that's and it seems to me that what we're looking at here is really a desire on the part of some people on the hard right to return to, and I use even the phrase return to advisedly, because I think in many ways we're still there, but to return to an era where women were just basically the property of men. That this is a war on women, on women's rights more than anything else.
You know, I talk about this in the introduction to my book, and what I say is all of it, because they're not just trying to ban abortion. They're trying to ban birth control. They're not just trying to ban stem cell research. They're trying to ban everything around this and so on and so forth. So I say in the introduction to my book, it all begs the same question. What in God's name are these people doing? Why are they trying to limit scientific advances where they relate to human reproduction? And I come to the same conclusion you do. I think that they want a country that comports with their view of the Bible. And I say, if it were up to them, they would not only outlaw abortion altogether, but also all forms of birth control except the Rhythm Method and abstinence. Embryonic stem cell research would have no place in their society, and on and on. Sex would be reserved for marriage and be limited to procreation, and AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases would magically go the way of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I mean, in 12 years in Congress, this is the conclusion I've come to, because the policies they're promulgating are so anti-science, so anti-woman, and so ridiculous.
Yeah. By the way, the fellow that I was speaking of was Dr. W. David Hager. He was an obgyn, and the Bush administration made him the head of the Advisory Committee for Reproductive Health and Drugs, Reproductive Health Drugs in the Food and Drug Administration. He was the guy in the FDA who was in charge of whether or not the FDA would approve things like Plan B. And this is from an article in The Nation by Ailish McGarvey. Quote, according to Davis, Hager's public moralizing on sexual matters clashed with his deplorable treatment of her. This is according to his wife. She alleged that between 1995 and their divorce in 2002, Hager repeatedly sodomized her without her consent.
Oh, my goodness.
Several sources on and off the record confirmed that she had told them, you know, and then it actually gets even more explicit. And then afterwards, he would leave a $100 bill on the...
That's just outrageous. But you know what? The last two appointees by the Bush administration to head up the family planning office at HHS have been opposed to birth control.
Yeah, I mean...
Think about that. Not just one, but two.
Yeah, and I don't think that it's just about birth control. I think that this really is... Because, I mean, we still don't have the Equal Rights Amendment.
Right.
I mean, there is an ongoing and you know, I mean, 7,000 years of history. For most of that time, women were the property of men. There's this ongoing war against women. And we know, for example, when women have relatively equal power with men, population stabilizes. It's, you know, regardless of technology or wealth or anything else, the women's rights movement is arguably the most important human rights movement and save the planet movement in the world. And these guys... For whatever reason, you know, whether it's fear or neurosis or some crazy male insecurity or whatever, they want to stop any kind of movement, any kind of forward progress by women in its tracks.
Well, and what's even, that's bad enough and it's terrible, but what's even worse with the stem cell issue, they want to stop cures. They want to stop research that could cure diseases that affect 110 million Americans and their families.
Yeah.
And it's all in the name of God, which is just ridiculous. You talked about John McCain at the beginning, and he did vote for my stem cell bill. But you're right. His record has been very muddled after that point. And, boy, is he running away from this issue like crazy right now. In the meantime, his votes on all of these other issues, Plan B birth control, and all kinds of other abstinence only, the Mexico City global gag rule, on and on and on. His voting percentage is zero.
Right. Well, he has voted to make sure that the federal government will pay for Viagra and will not pay for birth control.
Exactly.
Pills.
And so what I say to, the reason I wrote this book and the reason it's coming out now is 87% of Americans believe in science-based public policy. That's the good news. But those are the 87% who think there's a lot of other issues out there, and there are, the war, the economy, energy, healthcare. But in the meantime, the religious right only votes on one issue, and people have to start thinking about sound science when they make their vote in November.
Well, you have done a brilliant job, Congresswoman Diana DeGette. The book is Sex, Science, and Stem Cells, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason. Get out there and buy it. Congresswoman DeGette, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great being with you, Tom, and I'll see you in Denver.
Great. Look forward to it. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone, 866-303-2270. That's our telephone number. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com. And Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon. What the Congresswoman talked about, this is dangerous stuff, as you well know.
Bush's assault on science?
The assault, the stupefaction of America, the assault on the anti-knowledge, anti-science of the Know-Nothing Party, read Republican.
Yeah.
And when I tell people, and you know, months ago you talked about this Hager character, I can't recall his first name,
yeah,
and that behavior. And I've told people of this, and I've told people of other egregious examples. And I get from them, well, how come I haven't heard about this anywhere else? And yes, I blame the Democratic Party because they haven't gotten this crap out. And I know this is crap. I know this comes back to the ledger of you did this, you did that, tit for tat. But this is some dangerous stuff. And America should know of this man. This should have been a scandal. This should have been another nail.
David Hager is his name, by the way.
Unfortunately, it isn't, because the media is not interested in putting it on. I hate to get into a sexual politics here, and I hate to call a name, but this person is, from what I understand, she has the, well, I don't understand it. She has the Cronkite chair, and she has the editor-in-chief title, unless it's been taken away from her, Katie Couric.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure Katie Couric, I mean, let's get away from the cutesy Couric and the fluff stuff. I would think she would be outraged. Hell, she was outraged by Bill Clinton in the BJ.
I know.
Why
and
she want
Max,
behind Max,
Mark? I got it, Max. And you would think that Katie Couric would, And David Hager, this should have been a bigger story. I mean, the Nation wrote about it, and that was about it. It kind of dropped into the memory hole, and off it went. This was in the fall of 2004, and the story came out in the summer of 2005. And he just, kind of quietly went away. George in Miami, Florida. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Well, we're talking about a national health plan, and whether it's a right or not, I believe it's not only a right, but it's an obligation. And the reason is that I'm 75 years old, and I remember as a child, you go to the meat market, they didn't have refrigeration, they put meat on top of ice. And then they sprinkled it with a white powder to keep it red. They later found out that that powder was cancer-causing. And all through my life, I keep seeing things that later are proved to be cancer-causing, whether it was in the root beer in the 50s, and it goes on and on, the chemicals, the pesticides, the chemicals that are shedding from the plastics that we put food in and so on. So if we were to track all that, we would probably find a good case that cancer is just part, and these illnesses are being caused by the lifestyle we live.
Yeah, 60,000 chemicals have been introduced into our environment and our food supply over the last 30 years. 60,000 new chemicals, fewer than 600 of them have been tested.
Right, and I'm not saying that industry has intentionally done this. That's wrong. What I'm saying is that it has happened. We have the results of that. We've got a lot of people who get sick, and their whole life is destroyed due to the life that we live in this country, not due to anything they did personally. And their whole life savings are gone within a month or two. And so we need to have a national health insurance just to take care of the people who are being whose sickness are caused by the environment that we created.
Very, very well said, George. Thank you very much. And right now we've got this very weird kind of dichotomy that many of these chemicals that are made that are causing cancers are being made by the exact same corporations that are selling the pharmaceuticals that cure the cancers. I mean, that's where it gets curiouser and curiouser, as they say. John in Camas, Washington. There's a Camas. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom, real quick, a couple things just drive me crazy. One is the situation with Limbaugh when he talks about environmental regulations. I remember him once saying a couple of years back, oh, just take away all the environmental regulations, we'll have the best clean air and clean water. He needs to go to China and see what happens.
Yep.
I mean, it just drives me crazy. But, this oil thing, Tom, I really think we need to place the ball back in the Republicans' court. They keep talking about drill local, drill local, drill local, drill here. But all they want to do is put that oil on the open market. They don't want to keep it here. We need to say drill here, but keep it here. And then have them say no to that.
And drill now. I mean, they're sitting on 10,000 leases right now that where they could be drilling the oil, but they're not. They're just sitting on those leases. It's money in the bank, and they're not drilling on it. I think that Peter DeFazio, with his use-it-or-lose-it legislation, is just so spot on the 66 million acres of public land already been leased to the oil companies, and they're just saying, oh, great, yeah, we know there's oil there. We're just going to sit on it and wait for it to go to $200 a barrel, then we'll pull it out. And in the meantime, we'll keep it on the balance sheet. We can borrow money against it. We can make money on it. Not, you know, everything's just fine. Thank you. Oh, by the way, let's give us a few more leases, would you? 27 minutes next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Larry Craig scares me, the senator from Idaho. All his Republican buddies are telling him he's gotta go. You see, they think that being gay is some kind of disgrace. All around the Senate and the House, they make that case. The fact is, they've got enormous closet space, and that scares me. Dick Cheney scares me with those beady eyes. They get intense and glary every time he lies, which is like every day now. He's got a machine where his heart should be, just pumping out an evil philosophy. He shoots people in the face and gets away scot-free, and he scares me. Coulter scares me, and now I gotta be blunt. In my frank opinion, she's just a stupid pundit. And in the time of my day, she isn't worth the tick, 'cause she's nothing but a carny with a hate-filled shtick. But she sold a couple million books, and that's just sick. She scares me.
35 minutes past the hour. Fighting for the common man and the common good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Just a quick reminder, August 16th, the week from Saturday, I'll be in Seattle along with some of my favorite peers. Three of the smartest women in America, Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, Randy Rhodes, and three of the smartest guys in America, Mike Malloy, Sam Cedar, and Ron Reagan. And the tickets are sold out, but they're running a contest over on their website at am1090seattle.com for a few extra tickets there. Also, for both the Democratic and Republican conventions, I'll be with the Talk Radio News Service. We'll be doing the Radio Rows at both conventions. And, of course, from AM760 in Denver and in Minneapolis, AM950 KTNF, the Voice of Minnesota, AM760 Colorado's Progressive Talk. Downright strange stuff going on out there in the world. I am not making this up. Hooper, Utah, a farmer by the name of Rhett Davis created what he calls a redneck Stonehenge. He's sticking old cars in the dirt, nose up. Why? He says, this is just a fun way for me to say, hey, boys, I'm still here. This is my redneck Stonehenge. He's doing it to send a message to his neighbors that he can do whatever he damn well pleases with his property. Yeah, it's interesting. I remember Louise and I, when we first moved to Vermont, we were living in a little town called Roxbury. I mean, a little town, like, you know, 300 people. And we actually lived right on the edge between Roxbury and Northfield. And back up in the woods. And there were a number of people in Roxbury who had old cars on blocks out in front of their houses. I mean, it's not an uncommon sight. You see it all over Vermont. And some of the folks on the city council thought that, you know, people should at least put them in their backyards. And so they passed an ordinance saying that you'd get a $25 fine if you had a car that didn't work in your front yard. So this really upset. This is a true story. This really upset the people who had the cars, which was a whole bunch of people in town. And so in the next election, they took over the city council and they passed an ordinance that said that you got a $25 fine if you did not have a dead car in your front yard. So you had to get a dead car and put it in your front yard, or else you'd have to pay a $25. I kid you not. I actually lived in this town, and it was a hoot. It was just, I mean, it was just a great example of democracy in action. And you know, at times it was a little contentious, but a lot of the time it was very good natured. It was interesting. Nancy in Long Beach, California, you want to set the record straight here on something?
Yes, I do. My husband and I are both 70, and along with Medicare Part A and B, we do have Medicare Part D. And at Costco, I just paid $136 for 10 Viagra because it is not covered by Medicare Part D.
Right. I should have said the Veterans Administration.
Okay. Because, I just want to be sure you knew. One other quick point. You're not guilty of it, but there are a lot of people in responsible positions that use the term commander-in-chief very loosely. Therefore, there are a lot of people wandering around that seem to think George Bush or any subsequent president is the commander-in-chief of the general populace. And I wish you would correct that, referring, of course, to the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, that he is commander-in-chief of the military.
Yeah, and in fact, here is what it says. Article 2, Section 2, the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States.
Exactly, but there are a lot of people that say, well, he's our commander-in-chief, meaning yours and mine, and then I...
No, he's not. Unless you happen to be...
fights.
Right, unless you happen to be in the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Air Force, he's not your commander-in-chief, or in the National Guard when it's mobilized.
Exactly. Thanks.
Well said, Nancy. Thank you very much, and thanks for setting us straight on Medicare. I didn't realize Medicare didn't pay for Viagra, but the whole thing was John McCain voted for legislation that would authorize and does apparently authorize the Veterans Administration to provide Medicare, but not birth control pills. And that was the, as I recall, that was the question. David in Seattle. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
No, hey, Tom. God, having George Bush be my fearless leader just makes me want to hurl, but that isn't the reason why I called.
Well, the good news is he's not our commander-in-chief, as Nancy pointed out.
Yeah. He's not our Pinochet either.
Yeah. Yet.
There was another pressing issue that I was hoping you and the Congresswoman Daggett would have talked about, and that was the current attempt by the Republican Secretary of State of Colorado and the purging of like 85,000 new voters that were registered during the last 6 months.
Yeah, good point. I wish I had remembered our conversation last week with Greg Palast about that and brought it up with her.
That's very significant.
I agree. It absolutely is. And certainly our listeners in Colorado should call her office and whoever their other members of representatives are and say, would you please look into this massive purge that's going on in Colorado of voting rolls, particularly in low-income areas, because the Republicans are fixing to steal another election. It's the bottom line. And you can read the details of it. And, David, thank you for pointing it out. You can read the details of it over at gregpalast.com. Hal in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Hal, what's up? Nevada, excuse me.
Yes. I think Barack probably ought to, maybe save it for an October surprise. Announced that, with gasoline being a huge issue for people, essentially announced that he's going to be, that he'll be breaking up the big oil conglomerates and enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. I think that would probably produce a landslide election for him.
You know, it may well. It's hard to say. It would also produce hundreds of millions of dollars in contributions from people inside the oil industry, and particularly you'd see a 527 coming out of the woodwork so fast. You're right. It would have to be right at the last minute.
Tom, that's why I say he has to wait until like the last week of October and just absolutely nail it, and then drive the point home every single day. Just pound it right up to the point of the election.
Yeah,
they wouldn't be able to stop the message. It'd already be too late.
Yeah, excellent point, Hal. I sure hope these guys are planning their October surprises, because I guarantee you the Republicans are. Michael in Los Angeles, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, back to the national health issue. I wanted to bring up something that I grew up in the military, the first 20-some years of my life, military dependent. And so I basically lived with socialized medicine the first part of my life. And our military is one of the largest socialistic organizations on earth, you know.
Yep.
It used to be before privatization. But the thing that kind of makes me angry is that the people on, quote-unquote, our side of the issue, I don't think are making good enough arguments for national health. And, you know, we keep hearing all of these problems, but the money it would save and employers and just,
yep.
I personally...
It would make our businesses competitive again.
Yeah. Well, I personally have an HMO that is very similar to military because it's like one-stop shopping. Everything is computerized. They've got everything centralized. I don't drive all over town to different doctors and everything.
Right.
And people just don't understand what's really at stake here and how much better our society would be in so many ways with national health.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said, Michael. Thank you very much for the call and for weighing in. Scott in San Francisco. Hey, Scott, you want to explain the redneck Stonehenge?
Well, not the redneck Stonehenge, actually. Since you mentioned it, are you familiar with the Stonehenge War Memorial just to the east of you on the Washington side of the Columbia River Gorge?
I am not.
Okay, yeah, it's down State Route 14 from you. It was built on the mistaken belief, apparently, that the original Stonehenge was someplace where, among other things, human sacrifices were conducted.
Right.
And there's this guy from that area who was a Quaker pacifist, and he exclaimed when they told him about the whole human sacrifice thing, and this is during World War I that he visited and was moved to say, after all our civilization, the flower of humanity is still being sacrificed to the god of war on the fields of battle. So, yeah, interesting. You know, of course, it was completely erroneous that there, you know, human sacrifice was performed at Stonehenge, but it's a nice sentiment.
Right. Yeah, it is. Thanks for the heads up on that, Scott. I didn't know. It's amazing. You live in a place. I've lived here in Oregon for 3 years now, going on four. And, I work 16-hour days and 7 days a week, so I don't get out much. But I would love to play tourist. I've got to see more of this state and of the Pacific Northwest. And all the years we lived in Atlanta, all the years we lived in Michigan, actually, it's... And Vermont, 10 years in Vermont. I loved the state. Well, actually, we got around there. 45 minutes past the hour. Truth in broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
From the weapons of mass deception. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Ellen Radner on the line with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. You know, Tom, I don't know if in the last hour or so the Hamden verdict has come out of Guantanamo. I don't think it yet has. They are expecting it today. And today, the Pentagon, of which our very own Meredith McKenzie was this, heard from the spokesman Jeff Morrell. Morrell said that Hamden, if acquitted, can go to a review board which will judge his suitability for release or transfer, that even if he were acquitted of the charges that are before him, he would still be considered an enemy combatant.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, this is like, I feel like I'm in Soviet Russia, he said that we think you've seen a fair and transparent process. He said it was a good effort. We hope it is the beginning of at least 20 additional trials that will take place sooner than later.
This kangaroo court, is this what they're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, it is like Soviet Russia. I mean, this is...
They closed off the court and they didn't even let the press hear part of the evidence.
Well, and even the defense attorneys couldn't see or hear all of the evidence.
It is really quite amazing. And so that's pretty much what he's talking about. He also said the situation in Afghanistan is not urgent, and that despite the commander's request for more ground forces, troop levels in Iraq are not directly tied to a force increase in Afghanistan. And he said, I know much has been made of the correlation between forces coming down in Iraq and going up in Afghanistan, and it would seem to be the most natural transaction to take place. The truth is we're 2.5 million strong around the world, and we have to draw forces elsewhere.
Who's the he, I'm sorry, that you're quoting?
Morrell, who's the spokesperson for one of the spokespersons for the Pentagon.
I see. So this is the Pentagon's position.
That's the official word.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve also held interest rates steady, and they said that inflation is still a concern, and they voted 10-1 to hold the federal funds rate for interbank lending at 2%. And it lowered the rate to 3.25% percentage weights between September and April. So that's the total amount on that one.
Yeah, this I find fascinating because my guess had been that I figured the Fed would probably hold the funds rate low. And right now, the federal fund rate is functionally below inflation. In fact, virtually all of the lending rates are below inflation when you calculate inflation by any reasonable standard, like Kevin Phillips does. You know, let's toss everything into the mix. And when that happens, you see the currency disintegrate and you see commodities like oil and gold go up. But oil has dropped almost gold has dropped almost $100 in the last couple of months. It's at 880 right now. And, I'm frankly surprised by that. I expected that when this was announced that you'd see a $30 jump in the price of oil, of gold and probably in oil as well, and neither one happened. I'm guessing that what's going to happen is that right after the elections, the Fed is going to they're going to have to raise interest rates in order to prevent, in order to strengthen the dollar, in order to shore up the dollar. And I think that they're sending those signals right now. I don't know if you have any thoughts or insights on that.
Well, my guess is if the economy continues how it is, I don't see how they cannot do something with the interest rate.
Yeah, but the problem is if they raise interest rates, they'll make the economy worse.
Right.
But it'll also strengthen the dollar. But it also makes it more expensive for the government to borrow money. And we're now $10 trillion in debt. We just raised the debt ceiling above $10
trillion. That's right.
So Bernanke's in one of these situations where whichever way he turns, he's going to destroy something. If he lowers interest rates, he's going to destroy the dollar. If he even keeps it where it is, and you're going to see commodity, you're going to see oil. You know, if everything stays the way it is, in my opinion, you're going to see oil at $200 a barrel and gold at $1,600 an ounce, you know, 12, 15 months from now. On the other hand, if he raises interest rates, you could see over time, over maybe a year or two period of time, you could see the dollar strengthen. You could see the price of gold drop to $500-$600 an ounce or less. You could see oil drop, but you'd also see the stock market go through the floor. And you'd have, what might look like a Great Depression, but a major deflation in the United States. And so it's like he's damned either way he goes because of 30 years of Reaganomics.
Wake up to. I mean, if I were him, I would not feel good waking up every morning.
Yeah, there's a reason Greenspan bailed out of the job when he did.
Right.
You know, he had done as much damage as he could, and he was like, you know, with his Ayn Rand ideologies and just said, okay, that's it. I guess this isn't working. We're out of here. So
That's clearly what happened. He did get out, and he left us to poor Bernanke. The president is in South Korea. There were some demonstrations, there was apparently 20,000 anti-Bush protesters. There was a pro-Bush rally. They were broken up by water cannon, police. Some people were arrested, and the anti-Bush protesters were working on the beef issue, which you know has been a major issue over there.
Yeah, they're very concerned. They don't want mad cow disease there. We have an epidemic of Alzheimer's here in the United States. They don't in Korea, and they think that it's associated with our meat, and they don't want our meat. Ellen, by the way, I'm sure you noticed Huffington Post and a few other sites are banned in China. You can't get them.
Oh, absolutely. And, the IOC is supposed to be doing something about it.
Right. How do we find out if TomHartmann.com and TalkRadioNews.com are blocked?
We got to find somebody over there.
Yeah. Can you get on that?
We'll try and look.
Okay, great. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. Maybe banned in China. We'll find out. Thanks, Ellen. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com, plus our old friend Lionel, host of The Lionel Show on Air America. His new book, Everyone's Crazy Except You and Me, and I'm Not So Sure About You. This should be fun. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.